Welcome to Heaven Earth. I'm joined with Mark Jones, and we're here to talk probably about various things, but I want to talk about Stephen Charnock. Mark, you have a new book, or a new edition of his book on the attributes and existence of God coming out. Before we get there, do you mind just basically introducing yourself in a way that makes sense for the conversation?
Sure. I had a keen interest in the Puritans when I first became a Christian and was able to do some work on the Puritans, and I still very much live in the Puritans, especially Thomas Goodwin, John Owen, and Stephen Charnock. Those are my three go-to Puritans. So as a pastor of a church in Vancouver, Presbyterian Church, I like to make sure that, you know, I'm preaching sermons that are understandable to regular people, but I find the Puritans in a strange way kind of keep me grounded in terms of bringing together good theology and practical application for the Christian life. So here I am pastoring Vancouver 14 years and loving the Puritans for about 20 years.
Mm. Now, just as we get going to the Puritans, it might, like, I know that you were saying that you've done a lot of your work in the past, so it's not all fresh to your mind exactly, but maybe just in a big picture, like they're different kinds of Puritans, right? There are Puritans who stayed in the Church of England for their entire life, some who did not conform to the settlements there. Mm-hmm. There are some who, I guess, came to North America. So like just big picture, not all the details, like, can you just give like the lay of the land about the different kinds of Puritans, and then maybe specify the one, like a guy like Stephen Charnock, how he integrates into that typology?
Yeah. So it's like, to me, it's quite important to figure out, you know, Puritan era and defining a Puritan. And I think it's almost like taken for granted now that there's no real easy way to define a Puritan. We have a mutual friend, Ian Clary. He wrote a really good article on the taxonomy of Puritans and defining them. And I enjoyed it and thought it was good. But at the same time, you know, you can sense the exasperation in the author as well as a reader, because it's like today we get Puritanism maybe through Banner of Truth was the early 21st century. You know, when I first became a Christian, it was mediated through Banner of Truth. And then it started to change, I think. And I myself tried to change that. And I could sense, even with friends of mine who are Puritan lovers / scholars, that we didn't always maybe define them the same way. So for me, it was like mid 16th century, right to the end of the 17th century, maybe. Some of it would even maybe end Puritanism 1662, you know, the Act of Uniformity and when all of the ministers got kicked out. But I think you could probably go up to about when toleration was, you know, nonconformists were tolerated, later part of the 17th century. You can kind of get there. But that is to say, like, Jonathan Edwards isn't a Puritan would be my view. And people would call, like, Spurgeon the last of the Puritans. And I'm like, okay, like, what does that even mean anymore? When you're
that's, you know, a good point. Yeah.
Calling people in that era, Victorian era, Puritans. So for me, it kind of dies out with a guy like Charnock, for example, because he was born in 1628 and died in 1680. And Thomas Goodwin died in 1680. John Howe, I think he was 1704. I'm not sure. I'm just trying to remember. But kind of those late 17th century guys dying out, you basically have the end of Puritanism, which to me was like a bunch of godly men trying to reform the Church of England along godly lines. And so the need for further reformation in the Church of England was a Puritan. And after that, anyone's guess is as good as mine on the details you fill in.
Yeah. Well, the way, I mean, I'm not as familiar with people after 1600 than, you know, the 16th century reformers, but like the way I've kind of thought about it, maybe this is too simplistic, or the way I'm thinking about it, like, if you're a Puritan in the Church of England, you're really trying to reform the church in a way that minimizes how many adiaphora there are, how many ways that you can differ on non-scriptural things. And if you're not a Puritan but still Reformed, you would say that there's actually a greater web of things that are matters of indifference. Yeah. So if I want to wear vestment because Queen Elizabeth says I ought to, that's fine.
Yeah,
it's not
yeah.
hurting anything.
Yeah, that's you know what's interesting about that is, you know, it changes over even from the Reformation. I think John Hooper, he wrote, I'm trying to remember if he wrote to Calvin and asked him about the vestments, and Calvin's just like, whatever, just wear it. You know, there's bigger issues going on.
Right.
But as time goes on and different issues become, you know, people get, they're called the hotter sort of Protestants, right? By Patrick Collinson. And
the hotter sort?
Yeah, the hotter like, sort. Okay, they're sort of more like easily agitated on right. matters. And, but, you know, you see just changing attitudes, John Owen on toleration and how he's like, well, we got to make sure that, you know, we don't want to kill heretics, but we got to make sure we don't sort things out in a way where we couldn't kill them if we needed, right? And, but like Baptists, for example, is a good example. So a Baptist and a Puritan, you could be a Baptist and a Puritan. You could be a paedo-baptist and a Puritan. It doesn't really tell you almost everything you need to know about their theological stance. You could even have John Milton, a Puritan, who's maybe an Arian, still debated, of course, by scholars. And then you have Quakers coming into the mix and all that. So theologically, it's not the most helpful term. But my point about the Baptists, for example, is after the Act of Uniformity, you know, when you're kicked out with a bunch of Baptist pastors and you're a paedo-baptist, all of a sudden something you thought was a big issue between both of you and it would cause a fight and lack of fellowship, now you're kicked out together, you're having to do things in a different way, it draws you together. So you could even look at changing attitudes mm-hmm. towards one another based on persecution and how toleration works. So it's really tricky to kind of label things over a stretch of 150 years when you see so much happened in those. I mean, look at the 1640s, how much was happening. Imagine extrapolating that. So to me, it's just, there's no easy way to talk about this belief and that when you say Puritan.
Right. What is interesting, what you just said, that there's almost a changing sense of intensity on what is most important for unity. So if you're a nonconformist and you're a paedo and credo Baptist, there's a real sense in what you feel like maybe you could kind of link up in arms.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I mean, for sure not before then. Guaranteed that would never happen in the 16th century or very rarely if it does.
Yeah.
I think that's important. I think now, like, so this is me kind of just being in a 21st century kind of setting. I wasn't really born in the baptism wars era. And so for me, like, I don't get it. Like, if I see a paedo Baptist or a credo or whatever, it just doesn't seem like a big deal. Like, my brother baptizes babies. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I view, I mean, baptism is a sign and seal of the covenant. It's the promise of God for you.
Yeah.
And yet I know some people who say, like, if you don't use this particular mode of baptism, it's not a real baptism. And it just doesn't make sense. I'm not saying it's not true or false. My point is, I never grew up around it, so it just doesn't feel like it's that important. And I don't.
Changing attitudes to doctrines. It would be, I don't know, like, in-depth studies on this, but it would be quite fascinating to look at changing attitudes over the course of 20, 30 years, even in the 17th century.
One thing that is that I assume is consistent based on my limited reading of Puritans, is that they do kind of adopt what Stephen Charnock does so-called classical conception of God, if that's even a good term to use, but basically like simplicity, immutability, eternity, and all that kind of stuff. So there's still a strong sense, you know, the Puritans are Bible people, but they seem to clearly affirm the so-called philosophical attributes of God.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, the Puritans is one way to designate their activity within a particular church context at a certain time and how they viewed their role in the Church of England. But that's, you know, that's a piece of the theological pie that shouldn't be overstated, because when you look at the Puritans in terms of their Catholicity and who they read and where they traveled and all those things, I mean, they're Reformed Catholics, they're Reformed Orthodox.
That's right.
You know, there's a lot that would surprise people about the Puritans. And if you get things mediated through an old school banner of truth, understanding of the Puritans, you'd be shocked at some of the things the Puritans wrote and who they quoted and things like that. So, yeah, that's something that we need to recapture in terms of their breadth of learning, expertise, and all of those things.
Yeah, sometimes it's surprising. I mean, I don't know if you want to call these Puritan, but in the Reformed theological conception, you have people who are hypothetical universalists, Mm-hmm. Not meaning that everyone's saved, but that there's a free.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a, yeah. There are people who believe in things like baptismal regeneration. There's a diversity that's like odd when you think about how you and I received Puritan or Reformed theology, like you said, through Banner of Truth. Because, by the way, Banner of Truth is great, but they're publishing a particular tract, I think is what you're getting at, of Puritan theology.
They did amazing work in getting good books out and getting people interested in the Puritans, and we have an incalculable debt to them, but it comes at a cost sometimes when you kind of understand Puritanism through that lens. That's a helpful tool, but it's not the only tool. So I realized when I was doing my studies that the Reformed theology that I thought was neatly packaged when I first learned Reformed theology wasn't in fact the case. And I started noticing all these debates among Reformed theologians. So not only are they dealing with antinomians and Arminians, Remonstrants, Papists, Quakers, you name it, they're also disagreeing with one another. And you see the manner in which they speak to each other is quite deferential. And I think Turretin calls Calvin and the Reformers the never to be sufficiently praised Reformer. But then if you read Turretin carefully, sometimes he's totally clarifying Calvin or correcting Calvin, because Calvin wasn't as specific. So one of the projects I had going on with my friend Michael Haken is the diversity among the Reformed theologians. And we had a book called Drawn into Controversy, and looked at many debates in the Puritan era among the Puritans. And then we went to the long 18th century and did the same thing. So it's also fascinating to see how they disagreed with one another.
Yeah, and so they're disagreeing with one another, but there's the intramural debates, but then you also see, at least in the more Reformed earlier group and the 17th century Scholastic Reformers, interaction with the parallel debates happening in the Roman Church.
Yeah.
And so there's a high level of, I mean, I'm using these words that I don't fully understand, like hypothetical universalism and stuff, but they're looking at these debates that are going on in the Roman Church that are parallel to, say, what's happening at Dort with Arminius and and it's really fascinating to see the kind of broadness of learning. So when you think of like maybe a Reformed person or more kind of Calvinistic, Puritanical, neutral sense person, you think, well, they just have the Bible in front of them and they're not reading prior writers or even writers outside of their theological tradition. But that's not true, is it?
That's not only not true, that's like manifestly the opposite of right. Like that, it's quite simply unbelievable to look at who these guys are citing. I mean, the ease with which Charnock, for example, is comfortable with Francisco Suarez, the Jesuit Roman Catholic theologian, who was a genius. But, lots of other guys within the Dominican tradition as well, Jesuit. I mean, there's people that they quote. And when I was editing Charnock's work on the existence and attributes of God, there's people I've never even heard of. And I just look. And on Post-Reformation Digital Library, he got 240 works, like books that they, and I go, my goodness, there's 240 volumes this guy wrote, and I hadn't even heard of him. So it's, and then the languages that they're working with, and Charnock spent time in France, and he's quoting a lot of Amirot, obviously, and a lot of French authors. And then, obviously Latin and Hebrew, but then sometimes they're into the Coptic, they're into the Aramaic. And so the learning that these guys possessed was quite incredible, philosophically, theologically, linguistically.
And that might be interesting to note that Charnock, and I don't know this for sure, but he was outside of the established church, but yet he was doing Christian ministry, like he was doing pastoral type ministry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't like he was, University of Oxford, ivory tower type, if that's even a type in the 17th century. Yeah. But he was.
Well, he did go to Dublin, to Trinity College Dublin, okay, and spent time there. He was a chaplain to Cromwell's Henry Cromwell, who was the chief governor in Ireland. And then he ended up getting he did some education in Ireland. But then he was a pastor. Basically, he's a pastor preaching sermons week after week in a church. Mm-hmm. In different parishes. And so, you kind of have, same with Owen and Goodwin, these guys were comfortable in the high-end academic side, but then they were people who were preaching to common folk each week as well. And that's what's quite amazing about them, is it wasn't one or the other.
So before we jump, I want to jump into some of the theology of Charnock. Before we get there, it almost seems to me that the one lesson from the Puritans could be, if you're in pastoral ministry, there's no sort of conflict between reading broadly, reading people you disagree with, so-called academic work, and day-to-day ministry. Is that maybe one thing you can learn? Because it sounds like that's what we can learn.
Yeah. You know, I would say that when you look back at Owen and Charnock, for example, and they're learning, and Goodwin, and they're reading all of these guys, and Goodwin will say in a book, literally will say, Arminius saith well. So he's commending Arminius. Now imagine today, I'm writing a blog post and I say, you know, as Arminius has well said, people go, what the heck is going on? You know, he's a closet Arminian. And so the whole culture of learning today is so, sorry to use this word, but it's so pathetic. And we need to recapture a wider culture of learning, that you could write a blog post article, for example, or a book, and quote guys who aren't immediately in your tradition and use them for your purpose, and not be, you know, looked upon as a denier of the faith, which, when the whole Federal Vision controversy happened and New Perspective on Paul and those things, right, you had to be so careful who you even quoted, because it was like people were looking to say, see, and the Puritans didn't really have that problem. You know, if you're quoting Suarez more than you're quoting Calvin, does that mean you're a papist? Not necessarily. At least that's not how they saw it. So
do you think that's because they were able to kind of put together, you know, the categories of nature and grace in a more integrated way? Like, they could affirm simplicity beside the incarnation without thinking any kind of conflict was there. One wasn't just Greek thought, they're both true.
Yeah, and it's probably quite complex, but I think, you know, if someone wanted to be identified as a Puritan, for example, in the 17th century, that came at a cost, and so it's not like they were closet, you know, Roman Catholics, love Suarez, hate the Reformed tradition, but still wanted to be a Puritan. No one in their right mind would do that.
Right.
At certain times, maybe the golden era of the 1640s, as they were on the upward, but, you know, it came at a cost. Like Owen, Goodwin, for example, he gave up quite a lot in the university life to be able to stick to his conscience on certain matters. So if he's going to say, hey, I'm a Reformed theologian, but then go and quote these guys, no one's going to think, oh, he's a closet Catholic. I mean, he gave up so much to be who he was.
I remember years ago, I wrote a somewhat critical review of an N.T. Wright book. And had a pastor then, I think the next day, asked me have I given my heart to N.T. Wright? And I was like, I think it was basically a critical review, like a negative sort of appraisal. And I was like, oh, just because I read the book.
Yeah.
And that kind of what you were talking about, that my illustration kind of stayed with me, because it was just such a weird thing.
Yeah.
What you just said kind of made it pop back into my head, like, guilty by association, not even by saying he saith well, by saying I read him and I disagree here and here.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I don't repent for my use of the word pathetic, because it really is at times so pathetic. You know, I've been through it myself, and you know, you even quoting certain Reformed theologians, there were certain guys saying, hey, you can't, you know, Davenant was like the bad guy for a while because he was a hypothetical universalist, and now, you know, guys like Michael Lynch are proving how, you know, mainstream and orthodox he was. So it's changing with all of these young scholars coming through and writing books and publishing. It really is changing, I believe, but it wasn't that way 25 years ago or 20 years ago.
Well, it's almost like you're using history like in an ideological way, or like in a political way. Like, you're just saying, you're not quoting the good guys in history that I believe, and therefore you're out, rather than just trying to uncover what they actually meant by the words. I mean, I think Richard Mahler, you say his last name Mahler or Mueller?
Mahler.
He's like just been brilliant on this. And because he cites the sources so freely and clearly, you can't really just say, oh, he's wrong. Like, he has this multi-set series where he demonstrates some of this kind of broader Catholicity or broader views.
Yeah, and you know, if anyone understands how smart these guys were and learned, you know, it's Mueller, because he's seen what they get up to firsthand, right? And that's the thing. When you read the original sources and you see who these guys are interacting with, it gives you a sort of humility that you'll probably need right now to say, hey, you know, we're gonna need a long time to get back to this level of competence.
So, I know this is just way, you can't predict the future and this has to be your opinion, but like, what are some ways that we could kind of retrieve this, I don't know, the sense of like not being pathetic. Like, how do we become normal again?
You know, I think one of the things for me is the massive advantage, or shall I say, North America disadvantage that students at school. So it starts at the school, like middle school, high school, is, you know, kids are coming out of high school and they can't even write an essay with research methodology, anything like that. I don't even know how I graduated from university from high school and got into university, because I didn't know anything. And so we're at a massive disadvantage in North America. There are some schools that are trying to recover some classical learning, and I'm not even talking about classical education in as a specific subset of how people do things, just classical learning. Like, so that's the main thing. In Europe, you'll find a lot of students, even in Holland, for example, young people, they get kind of pushed into channels early on. Are you going to be a, you know, an engineer, or are you going to be a scholar? And you get pushed. It's like the old English grammar school thing. You know, there's this grammar school for the smart kids, and then there's like the general schooling for the rest. I mean, my parents were pushed in those directions, and so I know how that goes. So it starts way younger. In Canada, you know, you'd have to pay a lot of money or invest at home with homeschooling to get that type of learning jump start, so that by 14, 15, you're conversant in classical Greek, Latin, etc. So that going off to university, you're not having to learn that stuff for the first time. Or in our case, even finishing your MDiv and still being woefully inadequate with languages. So that's the problem, is we're about 15 years in our learning behind as individuals because of where we start. Is a very kind of basic answer that could be filled in with much more.
I think even to add complexity to this, like a lot of people do their MDiv and attempt to avoid Greek, Hebrew, attempt to avoid some of the more, whatever you want to call them, hard science type things, like the concrete things. And then even if you do it, it's like, well, afterwards you can use commentaries, but you don't pers like you learn enough Greek to know how to use commentaries, but you don't pursue mastery.
No, yeah.
And I'm not talking about being an elitist. I'm just saying, like, you're allowed to read your Greek Bible if you want after seminary. Like, it's not
No.
going to hurt you. Like,
Absolutely. And I actually I kind of have this view where I would like everyone to be learned and theological and stuff and up it a little bit. But at the same time, I think you can be a fantastic preacher and not know a word of Greek or Hebrew, because it's a different thing in a sense. And preaching is communicating to ordinary people profound truths. Now, obviously, these things help, but when it comes to like learning and writing and theology, I mean, you need those tools. But I think because some people have got away with being such good preachers without knowing any, like Lloyd-Jones was not very good with languages and Greek. You just have to read his like commentary on Ephesians. It's really amateur, but he was a great preacher. But yeah, if you just better be sure you can preach like him then, if you're not gonna get the learning.
Well, I can t I mean, so when I did my PhD, I would say afterwards I be Took me a little while, but I became a much better communicator. And it wasn't because I could use big words or whatever. It was because I learned how to learn. I learned how to think, to write. I mean, even just like a dissertation, you're writing a coherent argument that is spelled out over 5 chapters or whatever, that all is aimed to fit together to persuade someone of a thesis. And so, you know, you don't have to be that technical in everyday speech, but it actually just helps you to organize your thoughts. And so, yeah, it's not really about Greek and Hebrew per se. In fact, well, in a kind of a funny way, I almost feel like we over valorize these things. And so you're like, oh, he mentioned the Greek word. He must be like a great, you know, thinker or whatever. And it's like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I like, if someone preaches and says this Greek word means that, I'm like, okay, you know, my daughter could pretty much look that up. That doesn't mean much, but But, you know, that's not to say, I mean, it really is impressive, though, when you see all the languages these guys work with. You know, Futsius would go and meet a buddy, and they would decide to have their conversation over coffee in classical Greek instead of Latin or Dutch. Like, it's just, you know, it's a totally different realm of scholarly living.
And by the way, one note is that makes life a lot cheaper, because most of the books you want to read are out of copyright. They're just in different languages.
Yeah.
So you don't have to read all the updated English versions, translations that are like from Brill and are like $300 or whatever.
Yeah.
You can just read them in the original. However, you have done an updated English version, although I guess Charnock wrote in English, right?
Yeah.
So it's a modernized English version with footnotes. I would just note the clarify my, like, to add to my statement, I find books like yours with those editorial notes that direct you to reading hugely beneficial.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. Those notes. So I don't want to.
No, it's I'm all on board with that. And you know, yeah, totally.
So tell me about Charnock's theology. So he has a book called The Existence and Attributes of God that he never finished because he died lecturing, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're writing a book like that, it's likely you're going to die if you're going to be that exhaustive on the attributes. I mean, if I were to start now and try, I'd die too before finishing. It's pretty comprehensive, though. It's a book where classical arguments are brought forth on God's existence, you know, that God is before who he is and what he is. It's that he is. And so there's just a normal structure to how he does things. And it really is a mind-boggling work in many respects. And I think it's a book that, if I'm being honest, a lot of people will talk about and speak about, but I don't really know if they truly have read it carefully and understand exactly what's going on behind the scenes of Charnock. So that's one of the things I've tried to do is bring to life the behind the scenes of what's going on with this work.
Which is, I think, often hugely illuminating. Like I had read some John Owen, but, you know, just the death of death and all kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But then I talked with an Owen scholar, Crawford Gribben,
mm-hmm.
and just knowing what's going on in Owen's kind of life really opens up the door to, like, oh, I finally get him now. And even some things like the death of death in the death of Christ.
Yeah.
He wrote that early on in his career. And I guess later on kind of either disagrees or modifies what he was saying there. And so sometimes you read that, it's like this pristine final work of theology and like, well, no, it's
no. You know what? It was actually a popular work. He even apologizes for how he writes in a way that's kind of not academic in that. So Davenant's work on the death of Christ is highly, highly, like, we'd call it scholarly, but it's high theology. Mm. And Owen, Death of Death, we might think is high theology, but it's sort of mid-range. It's not like Bunyan-esque, like, mm-hmm. bottom of the barrel theology, but
bottom of the barrel.
Well, in terms of, you know,
I know what you mean.
Brilliant, but not like it was never. Yeah. Brilliant. And then, that's what's kind of crazy is people have this view of Owen's book, but it's not matching the reality of its context.
So Charnock, does he move into Trinity, or is it on the nature of God as such?
It's just the attributes. I mean, there are, like, you know, you can find the Trinity in there, but it's not a work on the Trinity. Like Francis Chenal wrote a book on the Parliament commissioned him to write a book on the Trinity. And so that was explicitly Trinitarian work. This one is the attributes. But you would come away with a Trinitarian view of God still after reading it, but it's not as explicitly focused.
Mm-hmm. So, like, let me, like, ask a kind of more like a big picture question. You're obviously creating this edition. Is Crossway publishing it? I can't
remember. Crossway, yeah. They're really, it's a huge thank you to Crossway for having the, like, Justin Taylor just, you know, approached me one day and said, hey, you know, have you thought about maybe editing Charnock's Existence Attributes of God for the sake of the church? Like, they wanted to do this for the sake of the church. And they're investing a lot of time and money into this themselves. Now, I know it's obviously a business decision, but it really, like, they've taken a bit of a chance on, you know, making sure we can get this done well. So yeah, this was their idea.
Well, I don't think, I can't see why this might be a secret, but they're also doing a new edition of the Institutes of Kelvin.
Yeah, and I think Owen as well, even his works are being edited by a lot of good guys, friends of mine who are working hard on Owen's work. So they really are doing fantastic work.
So getting into the head of Sharnak, we don't have to go like too deep in it for this, but just like big picture, how is he approaching God that might maybe differ from what we do today? Like, what is he doing in hundreds of pages that we probably don't do? our regular pastoral ministry, if you're a pastor?
Yeah, that's a good question. He's practiced medicine for a while. And so if you look at his, even the way he understands God and nature, there's a strong natural theology. And then there's also a strong like analogical theology where he's also using lots of figures of speech. He's using lots of different aspects of creation and how the world works. And then you've also got his like uses, his points of application for how the doctrine of God works itself out in our lives. It also has an explicitly Christ-centered focus where every attribute, you know, is connected to the person of Christ. And so, you know, it's really, it's painstaking in detail. And it's like, he's trying to unearth all that he can without, you know, he has to move on, obviously, after every now and then. But if you look at, like, I think his longest discourse was The Goodness of God. You read that and you actually just cannot understand how someone can think about the goodness of God so in so much detail. He just brings up things you've never thought of. So even when he will say, I remember this one passage, it really struck me that, you know, and I put this in the book I wrote with Joel Beakey, A Puritan Theology, that for a time, God showed more goodness to us than he did to Christ. So when Christ was on the cross, God was showing more goodness to us than to his own son. And, you know, little quips like that and phrases, it really does bring out the goodness of God, for example, or the holiness and et cetera.
It might be, I mean, maybe this is the wrong category, but it feels correct to say that he's more contemplating God in a way that maybe we do, like data mining sometimes when we read the Bible and organizing Bible verses, but he's contemplating on what's being said and sitting back and reasoning through it, presumably prayerfully, to reflect on what is actually true. Who is this real God that I'm
reading? Well, that's why, you know, I would call Charnock's book devotional theology, but if you say that today, it's completely misunderstood. Devotional theology. Devotional theology sounds like, you know, something you'd say, oh, well, this just warms my heart. But devotional theology back then is basically theology. You know, the Puritans wrote theology, but it's devotional. And so that's one thing you can't leave Charnock without feeling God's presence and a new view of God that it brings you to worship, whereas some books today are like textbooks, right? And you just feel, this is feeding my head, but it's not doing much for my soul.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, there's a book, I think it might be Edward Lay, it's called like Looking Unto Jesus.
Yeah, Isaac Ambrose.
Yeah, that's it. And like I think it's a devotional book, but it's on the scale of like what we might call academic, also massive in terms of his distinctions and articulations. It's fuzzy in my memory, but I can just think of him on Christology as being very profound.
Yeah. I read that book back when I was doing my studies, and it's again, you're right, it's devotional theology, but you'd go, whoa, this is pretty heavy at times.
Yeah. So this is kind of what we were talking about earlier, like uniting those kind of devotional and sort of, I don't know, academic minds together. Maybe one last question, and I want to ask you about book recommendations to finish the talk. So if you're like a pastor or church leader or whatever, there's lots of things you could read. You can read every week there's a new book on critical race theory or whatever. I don't know. I'm kind of almost intentionally ignorant of the new stuff in a sense. Yeah. So like, let's say in my church, if I'm a pastor or whatever, and I want to help people out, and I say, well, I could read this book by, on critical race theory. And that'd be really helpful because everyone's talking about it.
Yeah.
And then it would see this book and say, well, I mean, this is a 17th century dead guy who wrote hundreds of pages about the nature of God.
Yeah.
So I think most of us would feel like, well, the more practical book is on CRT or whatever it is, just fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
So, like, what is your kind of apologetic for maybe reading a book like Charnock over some of the popular press books that I mentioned?
Oh yeah, you know, it's quite a traumatizing thing for me as a pastor, as a Christian, as someone who has read Charnock and Owen and these guys, and I'm like, you know, so many of the problems we have today in the church, it's like our doctrine of God is so anemic that no wonder we're getting ourselves into trouble all over the place. Because when the root is malnourished and the root is God, you're going to have people who take the place of God in their thinking. And so a lot of the false theologies that emerge that you have to counter with books, whatever it may be, critical race theory or other stuff, it's really, we'll come back to a very anemic view of God. And you see that even in our worship as well at church, anemic God in the pastoral prayer, for example, in the lack of reading, the preaching is weak theologically. So yeah, I think to me, it's like, if we really want to see proper long-lasting change in the church, we've got to make the root healthy again. And that's God. Then we can have a common ground upon which to think and stand as we deal with all these other things. But I think a lot of these books are putting band-aids on issues, and some of them, you know, a band-aid's a good thing at times, right? I'm not saying it's wrong, but you really are just masking up a festering sore with a band-aid. And that's, people like that, you know, people want the latest book that criticizes someone and that, and I know myself what sells and doesn't. And sadly, a book on God doesn't always, but it's probably what we need. But that's just me being biased, and I'm going to stick by it.
What also strikes me that God is much more stable than the changing issue of the day. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, thousands, there's always a new thing, if it's the emergent church or seeker church or whatever it is. I think that we put all of our, I mean, I think you do need to treat these things like pastorally, but if we put all of our focus on them, in the end of the day, we've forgotten about God. Yeah. Like, I'll give you an example. This is a sentence or two that I read this week that was published somewhere by a leader, a Christian leader. He said, eternal subordination of the Son of God, therefore has nothing to do with Arianism or Nestorianism or Eutychianism. It is, moreover, an accurate statement of the eternal reality of three distinct personhoods within the single and simple essence of the one true God.
Yeah.
I was like, well, that's just obviously wrong. And yet that's relatively normal to say.
You know, it's funny you bring that up, because I kind of thought that issue died, and maybe I'm living under a rock, which is fine for me. But, you know, I was like, really, does anyone still believe this now after we had that like bit of a debate several years ago? And yeah, I guess people do, but to me, it's like, there's just no excuse for that view. That view is so utterly wrong and manifestly wrong that it's like, how can anyone who's a theologian hold to that and call themselves like a Christian theologian? And I'm not saying those who hold to it aren't Christians. I'm just thinking it's such a sub-Christian doctrine. And yeah, you know, if you'd read Charnock or the guys Charnock's reading, you'd see very quickly how you just can't make sense of that view.
Well, yeah. And it's, I think, you know, if you might have that view, but you have the right politics and it really doesn't matter. And
I don't, I mean, yeah,
maybe that's too strong of a statement, but it's,
no, I'm surprised people dig their heels in on that one. Like, it's just so, like, I would say, hey, you know, yeah, we were trying to protect something good there with regards to male female relations, and we overstepped our boundaries, and you know, it's time to rethink this, and that would have been great, but clearly didn't happen for some.
Hmm. Well, I want to let you go because I know you got other stuff going on today. But so this book's coming out when, Steve Charnock?
Well, I'm hoping that the final edits for volume two, volume one's been done. Final edits for volume two, I get sent back like corrections and questions and stuff, and that may happen in a month or two, or and then I got to send it back, and then so, you know, we're hoping that by the end of this year, like, things will be all ready to go to press. Now, how long it takes for them to
print it,
get it printed, all that, I don't know. I'm waiting for an update from CrossFit, but the editor I'm working with, who does the, like, you know, the more of the formatting and the reading over everything and stuff, he's working quite quickly, quicker than I imagined. So yeah, I hope we'll have some good news in a few months of when people can expect the two volumes to come out.
And you've published, I mean, a lot of different things, a book on antinomianism, Knowing Christ, which is your sequel to Knowing God, that really famous book.
yeah, that was, it's that one, Knowing Christ is my favorite. I like God Is a lot. Just people have really said that one on the attributes, which is me just reworking the Puritans and saying, hey, here's in modern day English. But I have one on Knowing Sin coming out with Moody Publishing. They've had the my book for ages, and I still haven't heard back from them, but it's, you know, it's finished. I just have to wait. Again, writing a book is easy compared to, like, the publishing process. So warning out there to future authors, it's painful waiting. But again, that's a Puritan, it's actually explicitly Puritan treatment of sin, which I think in the church today, you know, not only do we need a doctrine of God, but we need a really robust doctrine of sin.
Well, that's good. Thanks for talking. I suspect I should buy the Steve Charnock book when it comes out. I've looked at him before, but I never read through his whole mass of stuff before.
Yeah, you'll get a kick. Just reading the footnotes, you'll get blessed by some of the things. I think, like, I genuinely believe that there's been a lot of work been put into giving footnotes that will reveal a world that most people have missed.
Thanks, Mark.